being hurt right now. There was a case that a friend of mine who's a teacher talked to me about because she was really distressed, and it was a girl who had been raped the week before, and they reported it, and she'd been raped by someone who was in the extended family, and the social worker said, well, there's no indication this is going to happen again, and he didn't do anything.
Right.
And that would not have happened in Philadelphia.
Well, for instance, in this part of the country, I believe that what's happening to the children of the Aryan Nation in Idaho is one of the worst kinds of child abuse that you can imagine, where you're teaching them to hate.
Yes.
And that's community standard. And those children are being created to be time bombs to go off in the same way that, you know, crack babies are time bombs to go off and so on. And it really worries me that somebody doesn't intervene and say, wait a second here, this is not the way children are supposed to be treated.
I believe that Idaho laws are specifically focusing on physical rather than emotional.
But what more emotional damage than what's happening to those kids? To see them on television, you know, wanting to kill people as 7-year-olds.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot recently because there were two law review articles I read. One of them talked about when the state should intervene and what the limits of family autonomy were, and said we have to hang on to the concept of Republican virtue, and that that we should not have this attitude of liberalism that, you know, we are going to tolerate everyone's beliefs, but that the state has a responsibility to bring up its citizens to be people who can function in a democratic society, and that part of that is an openness and tolerance of other ideas, and that it is also a respect for the autonomy of children as well as families. And then another of the law review articles that I have here, and if you'd be interested, I could give you those particular ones, is looking at a case in Kentucky in which a group of parents objected to the Holt readers because they taught an acceptance of many viewpoints, and they said, that's interfering with our religious beliefs, which is that they are not to question that, you know, God created the world in 6 days and that homosexuality is wrong and that, you know, all of these other things that the whole reader introduced as something to think about and not just to accept unquestionably. And what the Law Review article talks about is how the courts never caught on to what the real issue was. And the Law Review article doesn't really conclude anything, but it brought me back to that other Law Review article that says we have this
responsibility
of bringing up citizens to perform in this society. And that there, it's not a value-free society where everything is welcome, but that there is a certain commitment to tolerance that is required.
In Meridian, Idaho, there was a case where a teacher now cannot compare an apple to a Twinkie. There's an open policy that you cannot compare an apple to a Twinkie because apparently one teacher did that a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, because apples are better than Twinkies because of calories and all that. One of the parents of a student in elementary school happened to sell Twinkies and distribute Twinkies. So now it's wrong to compare apples and Twinkies.
Yes, we can't.
Yeah.
We have to be very careful in the classroom of any value education because it can be seen as different ways depending on who's opposing it. Some people oppose it that we're teaching religion in the classroom. Some people oppose imaging. You know, imagining pictures to words or concepts or comparison. One teacher I know doesn't even do nutrition units anymore because she gets such flack from parents of teaching them what's our, you know, maybe my values on nutrition compared to theirs. But we have to be very careful because we get it from all sides. We get it from the extreme right, as far, you know, that that you're not teaching the same values I would teach. You know, and so that causes a problem. Or other people say that we're teaching religion in the classroom because we are trying to teach values. It's, we can't win either way. Yeah. We're walking on eggshells of trying to make everybody happy. Mm-hmm.
I got lucky once in with teaching in that. I did my internship in an inner city daycare center, and I was a nutrition consultant. I'm a home economist. Anyway, introduced them to all different kinds of foods and different things to do with food. And the best thing that ever happened was after one of these incidents, I was walking to the bus stop, and one of the kids was going home early, and the parent was walking them home, and the little boy pointed to me, and then she came over and said, you know, are you the one who's teaching them all this stuff about food? And stuff, and I said, yeah. She said, that is the best thing I have ever heard of, because we were showing them vegetables that other than corn and peas, and you know, just did fun stuff with food, and they loved it.
That raises a whole other issue, you know, in terms of the advertising industry, because very clearly, I don't care what anybody says about studies and scientific approaches and so on, very clearly the children of America are being abused through advertising and emotionally destroyed in many ways by advertising.
Well, the media in general.
Yeah. All media.
And corrupted, if you will. It's a value statement, I'm
sorry. Right here, once a while. We're safe. We're up the mountain.
I'm waiting for the clever lawyer who uses that as an approach in a lawsuit against a cereal manufacturer or something like that. Same as has been being done against tobacco companies.
We have a snack time in the morning because our kids start so early, and we try milk break, and we try to encourage the kids to bring nutritious snacks. Which one of the things we tell them is that they can't bring candy bars. Well, a child had a Twix. To me, that's a candy bar.
No, but it's sold next to the cereal.
But at lunchtime, and the next day, my principal had gotten a call from the parent. How come the teacher is telling my child that they can't have Twix? Those are cookie bars. So my principal came and brought me this big box. If they're sold individually, they're sold one little stick at a time, and they're sold in boxes of 24, and they're sold as cookie bars. And he brought this and dumped it out in front of me. This is Larson. These are cookie bars, not candy bars. So the advertising is, you know, to get to the kids.
Well, we don't have any standard American values anymore. I mean, there's very hard to say exactly what is an American value that we want our kids to know. Good nutrition isn't necessarily, you know, we don't all have that same concept.
No.
What is abuse? Maybe discipline in another family, and in years past, it was more commonplace to smack a kid around or use the strap or the wooden spoon or whatever, and which would be considered child abuse.
Well, in many places, it's still allowed in schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, not very many. Is it?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen
in the Midwest.
You can't touch a kid. We have to worry about hugging kids or the way we touch them.
We're in South Dakota, it's still all right if there's another person there to observe.
Punishment? Mm-hmm. Corporal punishment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Not in Seattle.
Pennsylvania, they can do it too. Really? Except in Philadelphia County, where don't just touch my kid. Yeah. Let me read through this.
Yeah.
Before we
I don't think we're solving world problems.
I don't think so. But I think it would be interesting for you to hear the focus of this law. I won't talk about minimal community anymore. We're going to move on to when the standard is violated, removal of the minor child from the parent's custody may be necessary to assure the physical and mental well-being of the child. if you do out-of-home placement, you are required to do the least restrictive and most family-like option for that child. But before you do that, you must make reasonable efforts to prevent the removal of the child. So that when there's state intervention, the first question is, what efforts have been made to prevent removal? You know, must we remove? And you have to justify that efforts have been made to prevent removal, unless there's an immediate risk to this child. And then if it's removed, if the child is removed, he or she must be placed in the most family-like setting consistent with the needs of the child. In Philadelphia, often there wouldn't be a foster home available because they were so overloaded. And then the question was, do we leave the kids there for a few days till we find a foster home, or do we put them in a group home, which was the only space, the only bed available? And children would be left in the home because they couldn't justify a group home for this child. And then a child died in that situation over the 3-day period it took. And so then the internal rules changed about that. In connection with the most family-like setting, regular and frequent visitation must occur between the parent and the child, unless it would be harmful to the child, even if supervised. So you can have unsupervised visitation or supervised. And in order to not have supervised visitation, you have to establish to the court that it would be harmful. And so as an attorney would have to bring in a child psychologist. You'd have to have a meeting, have the child evaluated before you can prevent visitation with the family.
I wanted to bring up something that involves both parts of that. My younger brother was removed from the home for raping my younger sister. And he was put, they concluded that he was a danger to both our family and society in general and should be in a highly structured environment. They put him in a group home with a family. There was one other boy there, and it was a very young family with a 1-year-old daughter. And they put this sociopathic rapist in with that setting, and the minute he got in there, he dumped the psychiatrist. He didn't do anything. And also, we had to, all of us, the whole family, go and visit him once a week. And my little sister, my 8-year-old sister, had to go. And it's like, this is crazy. And he was placed within 5 miles of our house. He could walk over to our house. It was absolutely bananas. I mean, just totally stupid.
There's so many limitations that are put on availability of a bed, the amount of money that's spent in the program or the program getting started, it's cut. That, as I mentioned to you earlier, it's time we put our money where our mouth is. And the only way things are going to change is politically, in order to have the funds for kids that we need. Or we need to, as a society, say these are our children, they're all of our children. Even people who don't have kids, these are our kids. And to all of us need to take responsibility for the upbringing of our children. And I think our churches should be more involved, other than just the schools. Being a school teacher, I feel that we get a lot of the burden of doing the taking care of the kids. It's a daycare. Parents are going to drop them off. And the parents aren't held responsible anymore. It's all the school's responsibility. The community is not taking care of our kids like it should, and churches need to be doing it, Rotary clubs. We need to involve our whole community in taking care of our children, to expand that.
When that incident happened between my younger brother and sister, he was 16, she was 8. My sister got no help. My brother was the one who got the help.
which is backwards to say the least. And we were told, and this was through our church, told she's going to forget it, she's not going to remember it, which is number one.
How many years ago was that?
That was, let's see, she was 8, she's 24, 16 years.
16 years. I mean, we have to come a long ways in our views of who's the victim and who isn't.
But some people are still doing that. This is in the Midwest and the Catholic Church, and they said, and we were, my sister came to me because she was terrified of her mother. And so I told her we had to make it stop, all this stuff. Anyway, lost it.
No help was given to your sister.
Yeah, and I still lost it.
You're talking about community and the church.
Oh, yeah. Also, we were told that my sister and I were not allowed to talk about it, period, between ourselves. There was to be no talk about it. The incident was forgotten, buried, whatever. And it's like, I was the only one she felt comfortable talking with. She came to me, and I got it to stop for her. It was hard. And the church wasn't much help. And
it's not.
And sometimes, you know, and if you get churches involved, then you get this church and state thing going, and some churches' values are very different from others. Mm-hmm. Like, there's some churches that I know of that are real intense into this satanic or cultish type stuff, and you get those involved, and you're going to have it. That's hard.
There's an interesting thing going on right now with a fellow in Seattle who was convicted of child molestation and rape, I think, and was released and went back to his neighborhood, and the neighborhood burned his house down.
Yeah.
And so there's been all this national Oprah attention and stuff. And he then moved to his brother's house, I guess, in Mesa, Arizona, and they ran him out.
His brother did?
No, the community.
The community did.
Found out about him. They ran him out of there. So it'll be interesting to see. We're talking about the failure of the law.
And people just take
the
things.
System to deal with these issues. And it'll be interesting to see if this kind of vigilante reaction will occur in cases where the black community in Philadelphia, I guess, took care of business. And in this case, the moms of that neighborhood took care of business. It'll be interesting to see if that's what's going to happen, because eventually I'm really curious to know if the law as currently practiced is not good for children, which I guess I've concluded it isn't.
I'm not trying to change your mind.
if the country is going to move in a different direction on a community standards basis, is that what the law says? That's an interesting concept, because the community might
say, okay, these are our standards.
Right.
They're here, and you guys are here. Get up there.
They burned his house down.
In the past, we always thought, well, if they went to jail, they got help. And they come back, and now we know as a society that this isn't the case, and that these people come back into the community in about the same shape, or maybe even worse than they did when they left.
Not going to put up with it anymore.
And now, if the father of the 4-year-old, 7 years from now, and now the 17-year-old shoots him, is the law going to do anything?
Yeah, the kid's going to be treated as an adult and put in prison.
The community in Seattle
would say,
do
it.
The community says that, but the law.
Yeah, in fact, in this situation, they'll probably say it was self-defense. Because I don't think that this kid is ever going to grow.
And there would be, the possibility within the law to argue that defense, that it was self-defense. You brought him back to me.
Yeah. And I knew he was a threat.
And he's going to do it again to me, and I'm going to kill him.
And I know what guy you put in there.
We have a case in Idaho, and the one who shot the abuser was acquitted.
Hmm.
Totally.
This is the all-timer in the city of Tacoma. A kid, smartest kid in school, killed his mother with a baseball bat. She didn't die, so he shot her 3 or 4 times. He cut off her finger to get the ring off of her finger. He lived with her in the house for 6 or 8 days, went to school every day, and so on and so on. And he was not convicted the way you would expect him to be convicted because she had been abusive.
I read that. It was, I think it was in the New Yorker, the story.
And that was just his last years, wasn't it?
Yeah, Frank Doe. Frank Doe was his name.
I don't know if he was.
And so the law now is failing in the minds of a lot of people.
Well, the juries are saying acquittal.
Well, yeah, and that's pretty interesting. Because, my goodness, if that wasn't first-degree premeditated murder, I don't know what was. And,
but what do parents get for first-degree premeditated child abuse?
Was it really, though? See, I guess I got it.
Yes, but in the old days,
you know, in the kid's life, it's pretty long time.
Right.
I mean, I think Ali, this 4-year-old, is safe because by the time his dad gets out at 16, he will have other ways to defend himself.
Right. But the damage done in that time is for their entire life.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 35 and I'm still working on this stuff. And I don't know how long it's going to take. Mm-hmm.
On the flip side of this, there's also the, I was reading in the Time magazine this last month, they had a thing on there, when they interview children not to testify, but to use as evidence in child abuse cases, and how easy it is to lead children to say what you want them to say, and how that is starting to really mess up the legal system.
Well,
because the caseworkers ask kids, you know, did he touch you like this, or you know, and kids, things start being reported that they're just not sure whether it really happened or not. And case in point, the one that they should talk about were some grandparents that can't see their children now for a long, long time because of what eventually came out and they swear that they're innocent, just based on, and it's, you know, they're going to jail based on what the improper questioning by the caseworker, and then improper questioning by the court appointed psychologist, and they build a whole case on these, from what I read. Because I think it can happen the wrong stuff comes out.
The supposition
not handled correctly because they're such impressionable minds.
And the supposition is that children don't lie. But if you've worked with a third grader or second grader, so you know kids lie. If it's going to be to their benefit, or if they even think that this is what
you
want to hear.
If they think that's what they want to hear, so they don't get in trouble, you know, for a variety of reasons.
So you just don't know why they're lying. No, but kids do know.
No, and it's very difficult for the courts to sort out. And it's troublesome because I have the strong sense that kids get believed a lot less than they should. Not that they're
because
believed more than they should.
Things that children just cannot make up. I mean, they couldn't have the knowledge of certain kinds of abuse if it didn't happen.
But I think that this focus on the proper questioning is good, because I think people need to be trained to do that. Now, we ended at removal, which is fine, because next time we're going to talk about placement in custody and what happens after removal, but also about adoption issues. We'll talk about, if we get to it, we'll get to Jessica case and other cases.
I've got time.
Oh, good, because I have the People magazine, but I don't have.
Oh, I'll bring the time one because I looked it up on the thing because the care package my husband sent was my magazine.
Also, a really good article, a real in depth article on it that you might want to read in the New Yorker, which was done earlier before this latest round. And, you know, just does the way the New Yorker does and takes its time and really looks at both sides and gives you the background and the history. And so, you know, I really think that you get more information from this one than you get from any of those other ones. So that'll be in there too. And this will be in there with highlights on sort of to outline your way through the law, preventing child abuse. There's also a really beautiful little pamphlet that I found at the bookstore on domestic violence and its aftermath. It talks about bringing justice and dealing with these things. And I just think it's just beautifully written. And it says, just has all these steps that's required.
For what?
For the healing and the doing of justice and the reconciliation. They say, justice is not a state of being. It's not a place that we're trying to get to. It's a process of correction and restoration of that which was distorted and broken by injustice. And so she talks about justice making in response to domestic violence.